with the eight worldly concerns, even if it is supposedly Dharma action, such as serving your guru, etc., etc., it will lead to a collection of good merits, which will fruition into happiness and samsara. But once it fruitions into that happiness and you have received it, the merit is finished. It is used up. It does not exist anymore. Like putting money in a bank account without interest and not replenishing what you are using off your savings. Once the savings is finished, then your bank account becomes zero. So like that, when you do any type of actions free of the eight worldly concerns, with a relative bodhicitta motivation, that action will lead to enlightenment. So when you become, when that action leads to enlightenment, that merit will not finish or be used up until it fruitions into enlightenment. And in order to become enlightened, definitely you need a good body. Definitely you need long life. You need wealth. You need freedom. You need to have the five senses intact, etc., etc., etc. So definitely you will get the very necessary conditions to achieve enlightenment if your actions are dedicated toward merit. So without having to directly dedicate it toward samsaric pleasures, you will get samsaric pleasures. Your samsaric life will be easier as you are approaching toward enlightenment. So the merit is used up, used toward its full potential. So if that is the case, we are making so much effort toward the Dharma, all of us, in time. Time we can never buy. Time we can never replace. Time we can never get again. Time we cannot get gift of time. Once that time is over, it is your most precious commodity. Once that commodity is used up, or part of it has been used, it could never ever be replenished again. So you are spending so much time toward the Dharma. You are spending so much energy in reading and studying the Dharma. You are spending so much energy in making offerings, contributing yourself to different Dharma centers, serving your guru, using your finances, using your energy, your intelligence toward the growth of Dharma. You are doing meditations, practices, offerings, mantras, retreats, pilgrimages. You are spending, in fact, so much of your energy, your time towards the Dharma. I think it would be very good that if we can get the full result of all the energy that we have put into it, if we can get the result of the full energy that we have put into it in the time and energy, the finances, which can never ever be replaced, wouldn't that be better? Wouldn't it be better to have a good life, a long life, health, wealth, position, also a good form, five senses intact, and still be going on the road to enlightenment, than just to get good senses, five senses intact, human body, wealth, position, and it stops there? Wouldn't it be better to have number one than two? Whether you have number one or two totally and fully depends on your motive, not action. So we must get out of this kind of thinking that simply by going to temples and making offerings, not thinking, not training the mind, not changing the motive, simply by doing these actions, it is Dharma in itself and it brings good results. It does bring good results. Anything you do in relation to Dharma will bring good results, there's no doubt. But the degree of the result you receive is the difference. The degree. So if we can receive 100%, why not? Why not? Since we are already doing the actions, since we are already engaged in the actions, since we are already involved in the actions, why don't we get 100% of the benefits that can be accrued from the actions? So since we're putting so much effort, time, energy, sacrifices, finances, so much toward the Dharma, even being here tonight is so much effort. We're cramped in a small room, hot, suffocating, no refreshments, one bathroom. If you queue up, you have to wait 2-3 hours, so don't even queue up, you just hold your bladder. You can go home, take a nice shower, turn on your VCD, watch the television, put on the news, get a massage, sit in your massage chair and sit there and just relax. You can do all of that. You can go home and do that. Why do you have to sit here in a cramped room with a weird Tibetan Lama screaming and shouting at you that you're negative and you're going to hell, cramped on the floor with your knees killing you, sweating to death, and the fans barely working, and on top of that they light more candles to make it even more hot. Why? So you're making so much effort even tonight. On a positive way, in a real and another angle, you all are making such an effort tonight, and it's Friday night. For the young people here, it's Friday night. It's time to get dressed and go out and have a good time. Hard Rock Cafe. For the middle-aged, it's time to go home and relax and get into your easy chairs and nice, warm, cozy slippers. For the ones a little above that, no offense, it's time to take a Geritol and relax and read the papers and see what's going on in the world. Why are we here in a cramped room, hot, sweaty, with a weird Tibetan monk shouting at us? This is effort. This is incredible effort that you're putting towards Dharma. Incredible determination, incredible effort, incredible energy and time. Out of everything, time. You're putting toward Dharma. So don't you think that we should get the best, the most, and the highest degree of benefit from spending this kind of time and effort here? And for that matter, with this example in mind, all Dharma practices and all religious practices that we do. How do we do that? How do we do that? We must make sure that we are free of the 8 worldly concerns. Very, very important. If we are free of the 8 worldly concerns, our Dharma will become pure. Our practice will bear fruit. We will not take lower rebirth into the lower realms. Our present life and our future lives will not be spent with uncontrolled attachments and their results. We can enter the Mahayana path. We can reach liberation. The hindrances and problems and difficulties that we may or may not experience during our practices will be able to purify them and to overcome them. We will be able to gain higher and lower attainments. Whereas if we do not abandon the 8 worldly concerns while we're practicing the Dharma, then the 8 worldly concerns while practicing Dharma serve to feed the 8 worldly concerns and make them even bigger. And that becomes a huge obstruction to liberation. Number one, we should not practice the Dharma to crave for pleasure of the 6 senses, to get pleasure. We should not practice the Dharma to be free of the unpleasant. We should not practice the Dharma to hear sweet, ego-pleasing sounds and words. We should not practice the Dharma to avoid ugly, displeasing words or sounds. We should not practice Dharma to acquire material things. We should not be practicing the Dharma to avoid not obtaining material things. We should not practice the Dharma for personal praise or admiration. And we should not practice the Dharma to avoid slander, blame, and criticism. If we are practicing Dharma for any of those 8 worldly concerns, from the beginning, to the middle, to the end, the potential results that we can get from the Dharma will not be fulfilled. It cannot come. Why? The state of enlightenment is bereft, BEREFT, or without those states. So how can we practice and have those states, and practice for those states, and out of those states of the 8 worldly concerns, and attain a state that is free of it? Illogical. So how can we pray, wish for, practice for, aspire to reach a state that is free of those 8 worldly concerns, when the very practice we do lead to it even more? So if we practice Dharma in order to get praise and admiration, example, let's take one, and with that example we can apply it to all 8. If we practice the Dharma in order to get personal praise and admiration, if our basis for practicing Dharma is that, on an ordinary, superficial level, the minute we do not get that, we stop practicing the Dharma. And when we stop practicing the Dharma, the Buddhas doesn't suffer, our gurus don't suffer, our Dharma friends don't suffer, they feel sorry for us, they have compassion for us, and they pray for us, but they don't suffer, and they will not get the results of that, and they will not lose from that. It will be you. So if we practice the Dharma with the concern that we will get praise and admiration, and people will think that we are good, and we're doing a wonderful job, and we're wonderful, it goes against everything. It goes against Guru devotion, because Guru devotion, the practice of that, is the surrender of these eight. One of the features of that practice. And to get the results of any Dharma practice, they must be free of those eight. So if we have, if we're free from seven and we have one, we still cannot get the full results. So if we're practicing Dharma for praise and admiration, the very reason we're practicing Dharma is to destroy the need and the want for praise and admiration, which is another aspect of the self-cherished mind or ego. So if we're practicing Dharma to get that, how can we reach enlightenment? We will only reinforce that state of mind, and it becomes stronger. Therefore, our practice of Dharma becomes fallacious, brings not the full results that we want, and the time, energy, and effort that we have so given over, so much of it given over towards the Dharma, will not bear the full fruit that we want. So therefore, what's the criteria? Not the Dharma practice, not the object of Dharma practice, but the motive, the very beginning. If we have been practicing Dharma with any of those eight worldly concerns, we must check them and see them and make sure that they are rooted out. Even on a relative, artificial, or superficial level, if we can start to practice the Dharma without those eight worldly concerns, we are already making a huge breakthrough toward real Dharma practice. Remember, if our Dharma practice is stained with any of those eight, we will not be able to receive any higher insight or attainments. Definitely not. If we practice Dharma for the sake of ego, for the sake of praise, for the sake of people to like us, for the sake of receiving material things, the very purpose of practicing Dharma is to be free of those, to become a Buddha. So how can we be practicing out of that motive? And if we're practicing out of that motive, how can we get the result that we are actually reciting, if not thinking? For the sake of all sentient beings, I will listen to the Dharma. That's what we're reciting. Or if I don't go to a Dharma talk, I'll get scolded. Or if I don't go to a Dharma talk, my friends will think I'm not pious. Or if I don't go to a Dharma talk, oh, I think I have nothing else to do, I'm bored. Or if I go to a Dharma talk, I can meet friends. So what we're saying is, I will attend a Dharma talk in order to become a fully enlightened being. But the purpose of going to the Dharma talk is not what we're reciting. So how, what we're reciting and the purpose is not matching, how can it gain results? So like that, we must be free of wanting to practice Dharma for the sake of pleasures. To be free from the unpleasant. To hear ego-pleasing sweet words and sounds. To avoid ugly, displeasing words and sounds. To acquire material things. To avoid losing or not obtaining material things. Craving for personal praise and admiration, or to avoid personal blame, slander, and criticism. There is an end to these negative states of mind. There is definitely an end. Definitely there is an end. Why? We can check it. The more we listen to Dharma, the more we actually engage in Dharma correctly, we find ourselves changing. We find ourselves becoming better. Maybe we have not made that great of a progress, or the progress that we had wanted, but if we check from the first time we had started Dharma up to this point, I think everybody in this room has definitely improved. I'm sure of that. I'm confident of that. So therefore, all of you that have started from the first day of Dharma up to this point, if you have improved, it means that there is an end to negative states of mind. Because if there is a lessening of it, there is an end of it. So definitely from the time we have started practicing the Dharma up till now, even when I check my own negative mind, from the day that I received the Dharma up till now, and I won't tell you how many years because you're going to say, is that all you improved? Is that it? So I won't tell you how many years I've been in Dharma, so I can avoid non-pleasing, unpleasant, non-ego stroking words and sounds. So, since we have started the Dharma, we have followed our gurus, we have did our prayers and studies, we have definitely improved, definitely. Most of us definitely, no, all of us definitely have improved, I can say confidently. Therefore, there is a lessening of negative states of mind. If there is a lessening of negative states of mind, therefore, we must conclude that there is an end. Less means getting closer to an end. Less doesn't mean getting closer to more, to an end. And negative states of mind are impermanent phenomenon. The definition of impermanent phenomenon is any phenomenon that is dependent on other causes to exist. So impermanence or impermanent phenomenon is any phenomenon that is dependent on other phenomena to exist. Therefore, when we think about it, everything that exists is an impermanent phenomenon. If everything that exists is impermanent phenomenon, there must be an end. So, my afflictive emotions, which arises from the self-cherishing mind, is an impermanent phenomenon. Why? In order for my self-cherishing mind and ego to exist, it must have causes and conditions. So if the causes and conditions are removed, the ego or the self-cherishing mind can be removed. Now, what we need to do is find out what is the causes and conditions for that ego to exist and to apply the antidote. Very simple. We've all been told they can be removed. We've all been told that our mind is clarity and luminous nature and clear light. We've been told that over and over in Tantra by all the great lamas like His Holiness. But when we read the teachings, we're wondering, okay, I'm clear light, but how come I'm not clear? How come I'm still getting angry, pissed off, and I tell people off, and I get really riled up at the spur of a moment, and I hate competition, and if someone's wearing a better dress than me, I wish I could slap them? How come when someone's doing better in Dharma, I feel jealous? Okay, I have a clear, wonderful mind, and everybody tells me that, but I don't feel clear and wonderful. How come? Of course, when people come near us, we have to feel clear and wonderful. I'm a great Dharma practitioner. I've done many retreats. I know this prayer, I know that mantra, and my guru is His Holiness, His Eminence, the great enlightenment, the emanation, the Vajrapani, Vajradhara, everything. He's very close with me, and he loves me, and I've received his personal mala, and I get to drink something out of his cup, did you? And I went to retreat with him, and I sat two seats away from him, and you on the floor. And I get to call on the phone and have direct contact with him. And when I email him, I get a reply. Do you? I'm a great Dharma practitioner. And we sit there all bloated and all happy. And then we go to Dharma talks. And we go near our Dharma brothers and sisters. And we tell them, you're not as advanced as I am. Oh no, I'm not so good as you. Okay, you're not. What? Superficial humility. So when we check, how come? Something's wrong. Something's not right. We have to keep checking. We have to be very honest. Are we free of the 8 mundane concerns or 8 worldly concerns when we practice the Dharma? Or is the very practice of Dharma increasing the 8 worldly concerns? if the very practice of Dharma is increasing it, then something's wrong. We are not getting the full benefits that we can get if we practice Dharma. So very simple. We follow those guidelines. We follow those guidelines. Wouldn't that be better? Death is very near. Death is very soon. Death is very soon. So whenever before any Dharma talk, the Dharma teacher will tell you, please develop a most supreme and most unexcelled and good motivation. The meaning is to be free of the 8 worldly concerns. All of you have gotten the piece of paper that we have passed out, and at the bottom it tells you what are the 8 worldly concerns. We should memorize that. That will be more beneficial than memorizing the mantras of over 100 temple deities. It will be better to memorize those 8 worldly concerns, and I'm not trying to blow your mind away, but yes, if you know the mantras and practices and all the initiations of 100 great tantric deities, but you are practicing with 8 worldly concerns, you will not achieve even one tantric result of one tantric deity. So, we should memorize the 8 worldly concerns and check over and over and over again if we are free from those 8 worldly concerns. And if we are not, we must work on it immediately. We must get over it. We must practice and we must immediately get to the point, because time is short. Time is short and time is running out. This human form endowed with freedom, more valuable than a wish-granting gem, obtained only this once, is difficult to acquire and is easily lost, passing like a flash of lightning in the sky. Remembering this and understanding that, all worldly activities are like husks. At all times, day and night, you must try to take advantage of its essential significance. I, a yogi, have practiced in this way. You, O liberation seekers, should do likewise. Lama Tsongkhapa. Husks means a husk of a horn is something that can be removed. So, we should remember, we should get to the point of Dharma practice. We should get to the point of Dharma practice. Death, the disadvantages of not remembering death is, I will go over quickly for the sake of receiving the 8 thought transformations. Disadvantages is that you will not remember the Dharma at all times. Even though you remember the Dharma, you will postpone its practice. You may try to practice, but your Dharma practice will not become pure. Pure meaning getting the full effects. The definition is any phenomenon that is dependent on causes to exist. Therefore, your negative emotions are dependent on causes. What are some of the causes? Not understanding the truth, not understanding the Dharma, not having wisdom, not having a collection of merits, reconditioning yourself in it, not trying to root it out or pull it out, not dealing with it or facing it directly, etc., etc. So your negative states of mind, our negative states of mind, are dependent on a lot of causes. So when we start removing the causes, that negative state of mind must disappear. Therefore, there is an end to afflicted emotions or negative states of mind, which bring about negative actions of body, speech, and mind that bring about negative results. And these negative results that we experience individually is samsara. Samsara is not a place we go to. It's an experience that we have. It's an experience that we all have. Why? If samsara is a place we go to, everybody in this place must suffer. His Holiness the Dalai Lama is in this so-called samsara. He doesn't suffer. But we are here and we suffer. Therefore, samsara cannot be a place. It must be a state of mind that is brought about by our individual, personal fruitioning of karma. So, very simple, whether we practice tantric initiations, whether we do retreats, whether we do prostrations, whether we serve a temple, etc., etc., or not, if we free ourselves from the 8 worldly concerns, we will be advancing quite nicely. And we can free ourselves from 8 worldly concerns, because 8 worldly concerns, or 8 worldly dharmas, or 8 mundane concerns, whatever you prefer, are guidelines for us to check our motive to actually get to the point, which is eventually cutting off the branches of ego, cutting branches off and eventually getting to the trunk and slicing that off and getting to the root and removing that. And the roots can be removed because they are dependent on causes. And the causes themselves are impermanent. So negative states of mind are impermanent phenomena which are dependent on causes. Because they are dependent on causes, once the causes are removed, they can be eliminated. Therefore, there is an end to your personal samsara. Then, remembering death and impermanence will propel you to do your Dharma practice freely, because of purely meaning free of the eight worldly concerns. And you will not lose your determination easily. You will not lose your determination full stop. You will continue creating positive actions if you are free of the eight worldly concerns and you remember death at all times. But if you don't remember death, you will constantly create more negative karma and become more unsuitable for liberation. At the time of death, you will feel intense regret at having wasted your precious opportunity. If you remember death, your Dharma practice becomes very pure. Your Dharma actions become powerful and effective, beneficial in the beginning, beneficial in the middle, and beneficial in the end. And at the hour of death, you will go with satisfaction, knowing that you have spent your life meaningfully, and you will get another meaningful result, that you can live with more meaning. You have to take another rebirth. You definitely have to pass, you definitely have to go on. There's no doubt about that. So we should be more worried about what's going to happen after death than before death. Because whatever is happening before death, we can pretty much see. We have it right now. We should be more concerned about what's going to happen at death. Death is certain. No power in the universe can stop your death. Every person that has been born has died. Even great bodhisattvas and yogis, even the Buddha himself had to die. In 80 years' time, everybody in this room will be dead. Within 80 years' time, every single person in this room will be dead. Some of us, our memories will linger. Some of us, not even a memory or a name of us will linger. In all the actions that we have done to pamper our bodies, to protect our bodies, to protect our friends, so-called friends, and to go against our foes, and all the negative actions we have done for our friends and for our foes, and in the name of Dharma, will follow us. So within 8 years, everybody here will be dead. So what will matter at that time? Some can be tomorrow, some can be next year, some can be in 5 years. And the terrible part is, it's all so uncertain. And therefore, we can't even make plans for the future. We can't even make plans. Although we blindly and ignorantly and delusionally and out of great conditioning, we still make plans. But actually, there are no plans to make, because the plans are not in our hands. We cannot run away from death. There's nowhere to hide. Secret mountains and caves and forests, huge skyscrapers and vaults, bulletproof glass, etc., etc., cannot protect us from death. There is nowhere to hide. During Buddha's time, there was a great battle going on between the Shakya clan, his own clan, and an opposing clan. And one of the Shakya clan members came up to Lord Buddha and said, "Please come to the war and use your miraculous powers to save the Shakya clan." And Buddha says, "All right." He says, "Call two soldiers here, the frontline soldiers here, and stand them next to me." So they called two soldiers out of the battlefield, and they were standing next to the Buddha, very confident. Everyone in the Shakya clan was killed and was murdered. They lost the war. They lost the battle. And as the last Shakya soldier was being sliced up by the opponent, the two soldiers standing next to Buddha also died. No one shot an arrow at them. No one stuck them with a sword. No one killed them or strangled them. They had to die. So the person that had asked the Buddha, "Why or to save the world, came up and asked the Buddha why. Buddha says, my power is only 50%. Sentient beings' karma is the other 50%. I cannot fight karma. So they all have collective karma to die. Even if they do not have the conditions, they will still die when their time is finished. So everybody else was sliced up in the battle, was pierced by swords. These two soldiers, even standing next to the Buddha, had to die. Because their time was over and their time was up. So, we cannot run away from death. There's nowhere to hide, there's nowhere to escape. If we are very wealthy, and we are very haughty, and we think we're a big shot because of our wealth, you're a real big shot if you can ride death. No one has been able to do that. No one. Even if we are strong and powerful, we cannot defeat death. Your strength, your muscular body, and your healthy bodies, and your great, wonderful, V-shaped bodies are not impressive, because that death is not going to help. Okay, for the guys, V-shape, for the girls, hourglass. Your hourglass and V-shaped, wonderful, fabulous bodies cannot seduce death. If we have miraculous powers and clairvoyance, we cannot evade death. It's even worse, we know when we're going to die. Oh no, I'm going to be dead tomorrow. You know? So if you have miraculous powers, it doesn't make a big deal, you're still going to die. One cannot add to life, one gets closer to death every minute. With each moment our life passes, we come closer to death. From the time we are born, from the moment we spring from our kind mothers, we are racing toward death. It's like a bullet train that never stops. There's no stops. There's only a destination. With each breath we take, we come closer to death. Each breath we breathe in and breathe out, we're getting closer to death. So we are to have 43 billion breaths within our life. Maybe we have 23 billion left. Every breath is getting closer to death. Even if we are asleep or distracted, we have plans, we're going on pilgrimage, or we're doing a business deal, we're signing a contract, we're going to get a big fat check. We're going to do a puja to get a big fat check. We're still getting closer to death. So some people avoid the subject, avoid the truth, and not face the truth, thinking that by not facing it, it will not happen. But in fact, it's a distraction, and it's a waste of time because it won't happen and you're doing nothing about it. And even while we are alive, when we are alive for 70 years, Buddha says, almost half of it is spent sleeping. Imagine, out of the 70 years that we're basically alive, our lifespans, half of it has been spent sleeping. The other half is spent working, eating, quarreling, shopping, traveling, watching television. Very little time is spent on Dharma. And even the time that we spend on Dharma, is it free of the eight worldly concerns, we can call it Dharma because it will bear fruits of enlightenment. Even the very time that we spend on Dharma, is it really Dharma? That's how rare and precious Dharma is. That's how short-termed and how dangerously close we have become to death, dangerously close to death, and going almost empty-handed. When we are young, we put up our Dharma practice so we are stable in life and we have some wealth. When we are middle-aged, we are very distracted, and every week is signing another contract, and after that one, I will practice the Dharma. When we become older, with all due respect, we look back with regret at all the practice that we could have done and we did not. And when we look back at what we have done in life, there's not much results, not much to show for. The lifespan in our time and realm is uncertain. Age is no guarantee. Children or younger people die often before older people. Health is no guarantee. Healthy people die before older people. Just in the last 2 months, a good friend of mine went for an operation for like the sixth or seventh time. Very sick, very ill. Her husband, very healthy, very strong. Never has to take medicine. She almost died in her last operation, but she didn't die. Now she's okay. She's preparing for another operation. Her husband died. He went to sleep. He had a slight heart attack, and he never woke up. And she's still alive and kicking, and still calling me up. Proof of that. Future plans are no guarantee. We can die before we complete our work. The very things that are meant to keep us alive become conditions that can actually kill us. Like food, housing, medicine. External conditions like accidents, natural catastrophes. Internal conditions like illness. In general, huge trees, forests, mountains, planets, all get destroyed. And they're so strong and big and solid, and our bodies are so fragile. If huge trees, forests, planets, and mountains get destroyed, what about our little fragile bodies? How delicate is it? At the time of death, no money or possession can help us. Naked and empty handed, we leave this life. A king and beggar experience death in the same way. Near and dear ones often give rise to attachment and pain. No one can share our experience of death. Death is experienced by ourselves alone. Even the very and last to add salt, because to add salt to the wound or add more dirt to the insult, to even rub it in more, the very bodies that we spend so much time, energy, and effort, and so much pampering is of no use to us at the time of death. It becomes a filthy, smelly, ugly, decaying, rigor mortis corpse. So the very bodies that we pamper, wash, take care of, worship, take pictures of, go get liposuction for, make money for, get facelifts for, go to fat farms for, eat healthy food for, the very bodies that we have pampered and been slaves to, we can call ourselves Cleopatras because we're all king and queens. Our body is king and queens. We're all Cleopatras here. And we have been a slave to Cleopatra, and in the end, Cleopatra slaps us back and says, "Can't help you." And on top of that, she smells. Think about that. And to add salt to the wound, to add pain, more insult to the pain, the very bodies that you pamper so much, that you love and adore, that you almost take pictures of and make offerings to yourself, becomes a beautiful, wonderful, blue, decaying, rigor mortis corpse that a lot of people don't want to go near because it's unclean and your spirit might follow them back. Think about that. Becomes a source of embarrassment, disappointment, disillusionment, and a source that is dirty. The very bodies that you have pampered. What an insult. When doctors give up on me, when rituals no longer work, when friends have given up hope for my life, when anything I do is futile, may I be blessed to remember my guru's instructions. The great Panchen Lama. How incredibly deep. How incredibly full of death. So whenever we attend a Dharma talk, whenever we do any Dharma activities, how minor, we should develop a good motivation that it will be free of the 8 worldly concerns. And when we start with that, and how can we propel ourselves to be free of the 8 worldly concerns, a contemplation on death and impermanence, as I described just now. And when the Dharma talk is over, today, tomorrow, Do not go back to your old ways. Do not go back to your old habits. Do not think that was a wonderful lecture. That monk is a great actor. He was a great joker. He made us laugh. When's the next show? When do we turn on to this station? Do not treat this as a spectacle, as a show, entertainment, social gathering, competition. Rick Center has more people. Whose altar is nicer? I hear those things. Or how many initiations you've gotten. And yes, His Eminence, Vajradhara Emanation, has emailed me, faxed me, written to me, communicated with me. Yes. So when the Dharma talk is over, what we should do immediately is apply it. Immediately apply it. Don't delay. Don't wait till tomorrow. Don't wait till your wife gives birth. Don't wait till you sign the next contract. Don't wait for your check collection to come in. Don't wait for your other Dharma brothers and sisters to start. Don't wait for next week. Don't wait till you move to your new house. Don't wait till you get your new haircut. Don't wait till you're in good mood. Don't wait till after your shower. Now, immediately. Why? What's the urgency? Because our best friend, who we don't want to be friends with, Mr. Death, is hanging around the corner. He's like a bad Muppet show. He's always there. Hello. So, it's very important that the minute the Dharma talk is over, that we must contemplate, remain silent, and not go back to our old ways. And not start gossiping, not start talking, not start putting other people down, getting angry, fighting, disagreements. And in fact, right in the temple, right below your guru, right in front of the three jewels, right in front of Lama Tsongkhapa. How could we? How dare we? How blasphemous? Naughty, naughty, shame, shame. The minute we finish the Dharma talk, it should go right in and not right out like a cup with holes, or not in and say it's not for me like a cup that's contaminated, or never go in, a cup that's upside down. We should practice it immediately. We should take courage and we should make a difference and practice it immediately. This moment. And not let it degenerate, but let it excel and grow. Very, very important. Very, very important. So, we will finish the rest of the four verses, which we have started, which has been really incredibly wonderful. And let's take a 10-second stretch and sit down immediately. You know my style, I like to stretch. No talking aloud, I got a ruler. Any teachings must quote its source and its lineage. Without its lineage, without its source, without stating it, its validity, it is not proper to teach it. And if it has no source or validity, if it is taught and it is practiced, there will be no results. Absolutely no results. So therefore, the source of these teachings are very, very important. There's a long line of gurus and masters that have practiced these, but prominent among them are the lineage of the teachings of the eight verses of transforming the mind is Buddha Shakyamuni. After that, the great Arya Asanga, the great Pandit Nagarjuna, the great Bodhisattva Shantideva. Shantideva. After that is Selimpa, the great master Atisha, the great Bodhisattva Khatam Gishi, spiritual disciple of Atisha, Gishi Potawa, Gishi Sharawa, Gishi Lamitapa, and Gishi Chekawa. Until Gishi Lamitapa's time, these teachings were secret, were private, and were exclusive. They were not allowed to be given publicly or taught, or there was no tradition, not allowed, tradition of teaching them publicly, because the thoughts there are so sacred, so incredibly beneficial, and if accomplished, bring great results, that many people would not be able to comprehend them or find the courage to be able to practice them. So until Gishin Lamitamba, through a long lineage, they were never, ever taught publicly. When he reached Geshe Lami Kangba, he received it orally from his guru. He decided, for the sake of sentient beings in the future, and for these precious teachings not to be lost, he had written them down and disseminated them to his disciples. When he wrote it down and disseminated it to his disciples, after that he passed away. So, the great Geshe Chekawa found a small torn sheet of that scripture, and all it said on it was, "May I suffer the defeat and offer the victory to others." He was overwhelmed. He was incredibly overwhelmed. He was very touched, and he was very moved by that very statement. And at that moment, through his deep insight and his force of powerful merits of practice, he realized that all the Buddha's teachings are contained in those lines. And the Buddha's intent are contained in those lines. May I suffer the defeat and offer the victory to others. So he started looking for masters that can teach that. Unfortunately, the author of that text, Geshe Lamitapa, had passed away. He received the full transmission and teachings from another disciple, and he himself practiced it and achieved it, and he himself started to teach it publicly. So he found it so precious and so beneficial, and he saw the time was right. Gishi Chekawa started teaching it publicly to other people. From then on, this tradition of teaching this publicly started. So Gishi Chekawa, through a long line of lamas, taught it, and it came down to the incomparable king of Dharma, Tsongkhapa, and his great disciples. And from then down to another long list of incomparable lamas and practitioners of all the four beautiful sects, until it reached His Holiness the great Kepche Pabongka Rinpoche. And from His Holiness Kepche Pabongka, it was passed down to the great enlightened tutors of the Dalai Lama, His Holiness Ling Rinpoche, His Holiness Trichang Rinpoche. And these two great masters passed it down to His Holiness the incomparable Dalai Lama. And it was in 1979, when I was around 11 or 12, that I had received these teachings, the complete commentary, in the oral transmission for about 4 to 5 hours from His Holiness in Washington, New Jersey. So I have received the commentary and the teachings from His Holiness directly, and at the teachings I was very moved, and I was in tears for many, many hours while His Holiness was teaching this. I was in tears because I knew what it contained was the truth. It moved me, it touched me, and I wanted to practice it. I don't know if I am actually practicing it well or not, but I had a strong determination, and I made prayers in front of His Holiness at that time to be able to practice this. So today, I have the honor again to talk about these teachings to my friends here, friends that I've known for years and new friends. By no means am I saying to you that I'm accomplished in these teachings, and therefore I can pass it down to you, and the lineage is passed down to you. By no means am I advertising that in any way, shape, or form, and no insinuations in that direction. But what I'm trying to say is, my gurus definitely have practiced it, and they are accomplished. So I invoke my gurus' blessings, and their great presence, like His Holiness, that you will be able to understand these teachings, and practice them in your daily life. If you practice no other teachings and you practice this well, it will definitely confer enlightenment. All the thoughts of Buddha are contained here. So as we've been happily listening to it, and I have been happily sharing it with you for the last 2 days, today is the third day and the final day on the 8th verse of the thought transformation. So please listen with an extremely good motivation, because the teachings are blessed. The lineage is blessed. So if we combine it with a blessed motivation, it will bring blessed and positive results. So we have left off at number 4, isn't it? We have finished number 4, is that correct? Alright. Number 5. When others out of jealousy treat me badly with abuse, slander, and so on, or let life, may I suffer the defeat and offer the victory to others. Again, when I recite it from memory, I memorize it in another translation form. So it might be slightly different, so the meaning is the same, so excuse me on that. When others out of jealousy treat me with abuse, slander, and so on, may I suffer the defeat and offer the victory to others. Let me please read the commentary to that for you. And the commentary is in this beautiful new book by Wisdom Publications. It's called Compassion, the Key to the Great Awakening, Thought Training and Bodhisattva Practices by one of my root gurus who's living and residing in America, Geshe Tsundam Gyaltsen. So in this text, in this commentary that's been translated on page 38, verse 5, if you shorten it, it means accepting defeat. This verse is one of the most important parts of this practice. It is the verse that inspired Geshe Chekhov to write the 7 points of mind training. If we aspire to full awakening, we have no choice but to do this practice. We need to learn to offer the victory to others, the compliments, whatever is noble and good, and to accept defeat and losses ourselves. This is the very foundation of the entire Bodhisattva practice. This is the entire foundation of the Bodhisattva practice. This line is the entire foundation of the Bodhisattva practice. The very reason why we hold Bodhisattva vows, the very reason why we take tantric initiations, the whole Bodhisattva wealth, in order to have guidelines toward becoming a Bodhisattva. The very reason we take Bodhisattva vows is to have guidelines and to promise to follow those guidelines to become a Bodhisattva. So the very purpose we take Bodhisattva vows and have Bodhisattva vows is to become enlightened. So if we practice this line and understand its significance and meaning, then the entire foundation is the entire foundation for your Bodhisattva practices. If we have bodhicitta, this practice comes automatically. Even in samsara terms, if we are able to offer the gain and the victory to others, we will prevail in the end. Even in samsaric terms is another name for daily affairs or daily terms. If we are able to offer the gain and the victory to others, we will prevail in the end. We receive the benefits. We all know that this practice is not easy. We all know that this practice is not easy. Indeed, it is one of the most difficult practices. But we have to start somewhere. If we start humbly, then eventually we will be able to do much more. For instance, if we can start by accepting 99% of the benefit for ourselves and give up only 1% to others, we win 99% of the times and let the others win 1%. Even if we have sincere interest in this practice, it is possible for us to achieve results. Even 1%. All the Buddhas of the past, all the Buddhas of the present time, and also all the Bodhisattvas who are at a very high level of realization had very humble beginnings. All the present Buddhas and all the highly realized Bodhisattvas that are existing today had very, very simple and humble beginnings. Some of them even worse than us. For example, Milarepa was a magician that wrought murder, black magic, hailstorms on his enemies. But he became enlightened. We hung out at Hard Rock Cafe and we're not enlightened. He definitely did worse than we did, but he's enlightened. This is something we need to keep in our mind all the time. This is the most hardest practice. When others out of jealousy treat me badly with abuse, slander, and so on, May I suffer the defeat and offer the victory to others. We will always have people jealous of us. We will never be free of it. We need to accept that fact, number one. Why? Because many beings are stuck in samsara. They are stuck in the delusions. They are ignorant of the delusions. They are ignorant of what jealousy can do to them, the harm that it can inflict on them and others. And out of conditioning, thousands and thousands and thousands of lifetimes of conditioning, they have acted out of jealousy. So what makes you think that you have the power for them not to get jealous of you and abuse you and slander you? These people, some of them even have the audacity and the great courage to slander Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, their gurus. So what makes you an exception? What makes me an exception? You are definitely going to be the object of other people's jealousy if you're doing well. Not necessarily that you are at fault, but because their delusions are out of control. And they have no wisdom to control their delusions. And they act out of delusions, and the delusions that they act out of bring negative, unhappy states of existence for them again and again and again. And in fact, by reacting back to these people negatively, you increase your delusions, and you increase theirs. So when someone acts badly to you, treats you badly, and you treat them badly back, you are just as bad as them. Your delusions are just as strong as theirs. Your ego and self-cherishing mind is just as strong as theirs. You are not better. Yes, they may have done something to you, and it is wrong, and they are wrong right there, but when you react back, you are equally wrong. So, when someone treats you badly, or says something bad to you, hurts your feelings, or is abrupt to you, or is rude to you, and you are rude back, and you are abrupt back, you are just as bad as them. You are just as guilty. Two wrongs do not make a right. So, if you are in Dharma, if you are practicing the Dharma, and you are still practicing in that way, and then you meet people who practice that way, and you practice that way back, you are just as guilty as them, and you should be just as ashamed as them. Just as ashamed. And you, in fact, collect the same amount of negative karma that they do. In fact, the same. If they treat you badly, you treat them back badly, what's the difference? Who cares about the cause anymore? The action creates negative results. And the very fact that you treat them back badly, and you abuse them, and you get back at them, the very fact that you do that shows how uncontrolled you are, and how much you are without compassion, and you do not consider how they might be suffering. You do not consider their situation. In fact, you are not sensitive to them and their sufferings. And you not being sensitive to them shows how strong your self-cherishing mind is, because you are more important to them, so you do not need to be sensitive to them. So in fact, when someone treats you badly, abuses you, or is rude to you, or is not nice to you, this is the moment for you to check if you are doing Dharma practice. And if you are not, that is the moment to start. If you complain, if you make noise, if you make a big issue of it, if you run around like a chicken with no head, screaming and shouting, you look just as bad. But if someone mistreats you, and is rude to you, or does not talk nicely to you, or has not been kind to you, you in fact, as a person trying to practice the Dharma, have found a perfect opportunity to practice the Dharma. What do you think? When everything is good and everybody is polite and nice, that's when you recite mantras and you sit there with your eyes rolling and incense and going, Om. No. When do you practice Dharma? When you are not chanting, when you are not praying, when you are not in retreat, when you are not near your gurus. That is when you practice the Dharma. That is when you practice Dharma. When someone shouts at you, when someone scolds you, when someone is rude to you, when someone has abused you, is hurting you, when someone doesn't agree or oppose you, that's when you practice the Dharma. May I suffer the defeat and offer the victory to others. Why? In that accepting of defeat, you win. Because it shows that your negative mind is becoming less. So when someone reacts negatively to you, and you react negatively back, you are just as guilty, you look just as ridiculous, and you should be just as embarrassed. In fact, you should react back in a way that says, what's bothering you? What happened? Explore. Check. Have compassion and see, maybe they had a bad day. If they didn't have a bad day and they're oppressed by violent sins and sufferings and they are overwhelmed with their suffering and delusions, isn't that an object for you to treasure, to check, and to practice with? Because without that, how do you practice patience? So if we do not offer the victory to people who treat me with abuse and slander and so on, we're going to be fighting one battle after another battle after another battle after another battle. And we will never ever win the battle, because there's going to be many, many, many people who will treat you in that way. They have treated you in that way. They are treating you in that way. And they will treat you in that way. And whether you practice the Dharma or not, they will still treat you in that way. So even if you're practicing the Dharma, they have, will, and they have, are, and will treat you in that way. So what's the best remedy? Fight back or practice the Dharma? So even if you don't practice the Dharma, they will still treat you in that way, the people that are coming. So what's the benefit here? What's the gain? If you practice the Dharma, you will be able to deal with these type of people. And as a result, you will start improving. You will start changing. You will start becoming a better person. And therefore, you win the ultimate ultimate war, not the small little battles. And after a while, when you practice enough that even people who are rude and mean to you, and you can still treat them with compassion, you know that you are improving on your practice. You know you're going the right direction. And you should be proud without ego. You should be happy and you should rejoice and dedicate the merits that you can increase that emotion even more, that positive emotion. So, when others out of jealousy treat me with abuse, slander, and so on, may I suffer the defeat and offer the victory to others. When we listen to it, it's beautiful. We praise it. We touch it to our head. We make offerings. We kowtow to it. We kowtow to the people who practice that. We respect the people who talk about that. We respect it. We kowtow to it. We make offerings to it. We make an effort to go listen and learn about it. Why? Because deep down inside, we are good human beings, and we would like to practice that, and we know it's the truth. Because deep down inside, we know that it is correct, it is the truth, and therefore, we admire it and praise it, and we would like to practice it. So the next step is to actually practice it. So the next time when you meet someone with delusions, angersome, hateful, who don't want to cooperate, who are difficult, think about the story I told you about Atisha and that monk that scolded him constantly. We should always think about Atisha and that mean old monk. Every time we want to react back, we should think about each other. If you can't remember, we should wear a pendant of a Atisha, and when that emotion arises, flash it. We should get statues of a Atisha, make pictures of a Atisha, and put it in our cars, on our dresser tables, in the living room, in the family room, at work, especially in traffic. We should have pictures of that Atisha to remind us how Atisha treated that monk that abused him so much, and how much we should practice. And Atisha treating that monk so well, he became enlightened, everybody makes offerings and kowtows and money to him, and we're still working to get that. In fact, we should think about that very carefully. So, and another thing is, any abuse, any unhappiness, and any suffering that you get from others, without a cause, there's no effect. So ultimately, you, yourselves, myself, ourselves, all of us, have created a cause to get that, to be in an environment that gets that. We have done things in our previous lives and in this life to get that, to receive that. So, it's better to receive it with patience and humility, offer the victory to others, suffer the defeat, purify that karma, train our mind, and advance. Wouldn't that be more beautiful? And are these beautiful words, aren't they music to the ears? Every single being in that altar that we kowtow to embody that message. Every single being that we kowtow and pray to and make offerings to, and we make offerings to them because they embody that quality. So since we so much respect the qualities that these holy beings embody, doesn't it behoove us to try to achieve it? And how to achieve it? One step at a time. One jealous, abusive, negative, hurtful person at a time. So one person at a time. So in fact, if you really want to practice the Dharma, you should set up a stall and say, please abuse me. If you really want to be enlightened, please abuse me. Please someone say something ugly to me. And when someone does, sit there with a big smile, happy, excited. Can you come back tomorrow and do this? Can we make an appointment? When? And if they cancel, why? Don't get angry if they cancel. That's not the purpose here. But in fact, you should set up a little stall that just says, abuse me. Slander me. Show me disrespect. Hurt me. Do something to me. Please. I want to become a Buddha. Please. I want to be a Bodhisattva. Please, 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 please. Most of us, when we see it coming, get in the bullet train and scram and beat it and get away. When we see the person that we don't like, we set up stalls. Don't abuse me because I want to be enlightened. Doesn't make sense. In fact, every person that abuse us, this is not a psychological mind game. It's the result of our negative karma, number one. Number two, gives us an opportunity to practice that. And when they do that to us and we can't offer them victory, it is a meter, like a petrol meter, to see how much we have practiced or not practiced. In fact, so these beings should be held as rare ones, like a precious treasure. Why a precious treasure? Because a precious treasure can confer many material wealth and gifts and comforts. So these beings can confer the six paramitas: patience, effort, wisdom, giving, meditation, meditative concentration, enthusiasm, etc., etc. They allow you that opportunity. They allow you the opportunity to practice. And in fact, without them, you cannot become enlightened. As I explained to you all my friends on the first day, it is in dependence on all sentient beings that you can gain attainments. It is dependent. So, as I told you, if there's 5 billion people on this planet and you love 499.99999, and there's one being that really gets on your nerves and you hate them, guess what? You can't get enlightened. You can't become a Buddha. You can't even get the higher results. You can't get even an ounce of bodhicitta. Forget ultimate bodhicitta, not even relative bodhicitta. Because your enlightenment depends on them. You need an object to have compassion to. You need an object to be compassionate to offer the victory to, so you can be called a bodhisattva. Your label bodhisattva depends on them. depends on every single sentient being, Kamsa in Tibetan, that exists on this planet, in the three worlds, form, formless, and desire, in